Well, we're going back to the story of Roswell in a moment with Linda Moulton Howe. This is a dandy, and I'm sure you have not heard about this one. So stand by. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. And in the last hour of the program tonight, of course, we'll have conversations with Linda. Now, this report that has to do with Roswell, and Linda, I've never heard of this one before. How did you find this?
Well, these people are finding me because of Earth Files and Coast and Dreamland, and they sit on knowledge for a long, long time. This man who came to me on this one had not really talked to anybody, and he said in his first email to me that he had decided that it was time that he try to tell me what he had learned from his father. And I received this email on December 1st, so I've only known about this the last 3 weeks, and it was from a man who is now 57 years old, and his name, he has given me permission to use his full name and his father's name. He wasn't sure in the beginning, and then on the record with the audio going, he said, yes, you can use my name, and you can use my father's name, and his name is Patrick Amp, A-M-P, another initial L, Murphy. He served as an FB-111 bomber crew chief, also known as an FB-111 bomber crew chief and inspector for the 509th Bomb Wing at Pease Air Force Base in New Hampshire after duty in Vietnam. Patrick worked with the 509th Bomb Wing from January of 73 to May of 75, and his father, Francis R. Murphy, born in Springfield, Massachusetts in 1905, had enlisted in the U.S. Army in 1940. During World War II, he was promoted to captain and was assigned to the 8th Army Air Corps with an intelligence unit on the front lines. The father worked in North Africa Desert Wars and then was in Naples, Italy until the war ended in 1945. Captain Murphy was wounded 4 times, received 4 Purple Hearts, and a Bronze Star. From Italy, Captain Murphy was assigned to Roswell Army Airfield, New Mexico, in late 1945 through 1947 to early 1948. Patrick Murphy, the son, emailed a phone number saying that he would like to talk with me about what his father told him concerning July 1947, when suddenly all was plunged into high secrecy and big shots, as he called them, came to the base, and his father, with a top secret clearance, who normally handled shipping projects for the RAAF, was not allowed to even enter an off-limits hangar where, quote, body parts that were not human, close quote, were crated for shipment by planes to Wright Field near Dayton, Ohio. Here now is Patrick Murphy, former FB-111 bomber crew chief and inspector from the U.S. Air Force's 509th Bomb Wing at Pease Air Force Base, New Hampshire, whose father knew about non-human body parts in off-limits hangars at Roswell Army Airfield in July 1947.
He had told me also they had sightings around New Mexico quite a few times before July UFO did crash.
So he's working for the 509th Bomber Wing in Roswell, New Mexico, 46 to 47. And your father, working intelligence, is aware that people are reporting these strange disc and triangular shaped craft in the skies around Roswell.
Yes. He says 8 P-51s were stationed at Roswell that weren't there before. Within a week of the time of the flying saucer incident with Mr. Arnold in the Northwest, the P-51s were stationed there, and they were always armed. They weren't just there for training. And these planes were well-equipped for offensive, not just defensive, capability.
And that occurred after the Kenneth Arnold report, the third week of June, 1947. And what then happened that your father told you firsthand at Roswell, at the Army Airfield in July?
In July, when the UFO supposedly crashed, the base was told not to leave. I believe he said it was the first 48 hours. People were told to be staying on the base. There was no leaves. Everybody that was off base was told to come back to the base. And I said, well, what happened with you at Roswell? UFOs? He showed up the second and third day after the crash. That's how fast they had got organized enough to get these things off the base. This stuff was all gone within 4 days total. From the time of the accident until the time the cargo planes started moving the stuff, it was all done and over with within 4 days.
Why did he use the term accident?
Originally, they thought it was a plane crash, and that's just what he kept calling it, was an accident. He never called it a crash. He never called it a UFO. He said it was an accident, and that was it. And he did remember seeing cargo planes coming in within 8 to 10 hours of the supposed crash. He also remembered ambulances right after the crash coming onto the base. 3 Army ambulances that are coming to the base. He doesn't know what was in them. He didn't know that until a few days later. He was talking to one of the security guards. And they were talking at a bar. He said, you wouldn't believe what was in those crates.
Like what?
He said there was strange-looking metal. He said there were things in there that he'd never seen as far as colors, shapes. He says the biggest piece was probably 4 by 5 feet. My dad, it was strange for him, for he'd never seen it before. My father, he says, what happened? Was it a plane crash? Who was hurt? Why are they coming here? And the security guy said all he saw was pieces of bodies. He never saw an entire body. He'd only had the glimpse of coming out of one ambulance and going into this hangar. And at that time, the hangar was totally closed, except for higher-ranking security officers, not the private. They were stationed on the outside of the hangar. People with experience and higher rank were allowed into the hangar area.
Did your father go in the hangar?
He couldn't get in. Top secret clearance, and he couldn't get in. My father was very curious because he did have top secret clearance. And that's when a security officer had told him he had seen parts of bodies inside the hangar. They didn't look human.
And the security guard said to your father, the bodies are not human.
Exactly, yeah. And what he saw was not human, and it wasn't a complete body. And then 3 days later is when they started removing the crates that they were moving. My father was partly in charge of that, making sure they were loaded on the airplanes going to Wright-Patterson. He believes the biggest box was 4 to 5 feet, and there was no manifest.
Your father read the original report about non-humans and technology from someplace else?
Yes, he read all that.
And what did he say it said?
He had just told me that they had recovered bodies. He didn't know how many. He thought it was 3 or 4. He said it was body parts. And in the report, he read they were small. It didn't appear human. In the report, it's exactly that. Not human body parts found at the site. He couldn't understand why they changed the report afterwards. That was one thing that always confused him and made him start wondering what was going on.
Did your father ever say to you, I saw a date on the document that I was reading and it said?
He knew it was July before his birthday. He was born the 24th of July.
If your father was in intelligence and had served in the war and had 4 Purple Hearts and a Bronze Star, why is it that your father couldn't ask one of his commanding officers, what has happened here?
Every time he tried to do anything like that, after the first or second day, he said he couldn't even get near any of the stuff. He did have top secret clearance, and he did approach a colonel. And my father was told he had no need to know, and if there was a need for him to know any information, then he would inform later, and he never was. My father was in charge of helping the crates get on the airplanes going to Wright-Patterson. He said that the crates were anywhere from 4 to 5 feet, to smaller boxes, 2 feet or smaller. You never got to see a manifest. There was no manifest as far as he ever saw. He was in charge of this type of thing as far as shipping. That's one of his jobs. And crates are just merely numbered. My father in World War II had never, ever seen any cargo, no matter how small, did not have a manifest and shipping orders. And these boxes are just merely numbered and having right field marked on them. That was it. The name of the field they were going to, And numbers. That was it.
If there are 2 or 3 days of 3 cargo planes leaving Roswell Army Airfield, going to Wright Field in Ohio and back, transporting boxes and coming back to Roswell for more, they must have transported a tremendous debris field to Wright Field.
My father said there was planes that could have been the size of a B-29. Those are pretty large airplanes. He said that's how much these boxes could fill. He described how the boxes were brought in to the hangar full when they got there. They were brought that way from wherever the cargo trucks were coming from.
And your father never asked to see what was in these cargo boxes that he was overseeing?
Colonel said again there was no need to know. And in those days, you did what you were told. And with his years of experience, that's how he was. He was military and he knew the rules and what you say and don't say.
Did your father ever see photographs or details about these non-human bodies that were taken into this hangar off limits at Roswell Army Airfield in July of 47?
No, he never got to see anything. I don't know if he was told something before he left the service. I don't know if they had to sign something after that.
In 1995, before he died, did he tell you any more details about what he knew firsthand serving for the 509th Bomber Wing in the Roswell Army Airfield in July of 47?
I was in the Air Force, and when I got back from Vietnam, I was stationed with the 509th at Pease Air Force Base in New Hampshire. That's about the only contact we had as far as really talking about the 509th itself, because I was in the 509th. We were watching a UFO show, and he told me flying saucers. That's what they were calling them at the base.
What is your perspective today in December of 2011 about the entire UFO phenomena and the history of what circulated around the Roswell, New Mexico crashes, plural, of July 1947?
I believe it was a UFO because my father would have said if it was a B-17 or a B-29, if it was a particular airplane that had crashed, he would have said something. He told me everything about North Africa, and he told me everything about Naples and the things he had done, but he had never really got involved much with what happened at Roswell. It was something like he didn't want to talk about, except for what he'd already told me. He didn't want me to dwell on it.
Well, it sounds like that the men and women who were at the Roswell Army Airfield in July of 1947 were warned and given the most strict orders to never talk about extraterrestrial biological entities crashing.
But you did say it after that accident or crash that it was quite a while before big shots left the base. They were there for quite a while. You said 2 or 3 weeks.
Who would have been the big shots?
Generals and colonels and above to him. He was a captain. So anybody above him would be somebody with power. But he just said there were a lot of high officers. He called them big shot people that stayed on the base and stayed in town and then left. They never really talked to him. They never saw him doing anything out of the ordinary. But he just couldn't understand why they were on the base as long as they were.
And they were there for 2 weeks?
2 to 3 weeks, yeah.
In July of 1947?
From July to August, yep.
I believe him, Linda.
Oh, absolutely. And George, who could some of those big shots be? Well, I think in one of the most significant leaked documents to Bob and Ryan Wood is one top secret ultra interplanetary phenomena unit summary, an intelligence assessment with the date of July 22nd, 1947. And it begins paragraph one, the extraordinary recovery of fallen airborne objects in the state of New Mexico between 4 July and 6 July 1947. And it goes in to with other documents into discussion about three vehicles that were shaped like wedges, curved, planform. They were not disks, and that they had come down, one near the Trinity site in northern White Sands Proving Ground. One had come down between Corona and Roswell, and another had come down 30 miles east of Alamogordo on the Mescalero Indian Reservation. And in this interplanetary phenomenon unit report, I'm just quoting, to give you a feeling of what that father, Captain Patrick Murphy's father, When he said big shots, he wasn't kidding. Here's the quote. Select scientists from the General Advisory Committee of the Atomic Energy Commission, most notably Dr. J. Robert Oppenheimer, was identified at Landing Zone 2, that was at the White Sands Trinity site, as well as other members. Among paperclip specialists identified at Landing Zone 2 were Dr. Wernher von Braun, Dr. Ernst Steinhoff, and Dr. Hubertus Strughold. These were all very important people from three different fields. Because of the stringent security measures that were in place at all the crash sites, the team was not able to gain access to the several locations where wreckage and bodies are being held. CIC, which was the counterintelligence corps that preceded later on the CIA that came into being in September of 1947, CIC member of the team was able to learn that several bodies were taken to the hospital at Roswell Army Airfield, and others went to either Los Alamos, Wright Field in Ohio, Patterson Airfield in Ohio, and Randolph Field for security reasons. It is believed that this dispersion was on the orders of General Thomas Handy, 4th Army Headquarters. Remains of the power plant were taken to Alamogordo Army Airfield and Kirtland Army Airfield in Albuquerque. Structural debris and assorted parts were taken to AMC at Wright Field. Other remains were transported across the White Sands Proving Ground to the storage facilities of the Naval Research Lab there. All of this was accomplished by 17:30 hours mountain time of July 7th. That definitely reinforces what Patrick Murphy just told us, that everything was done within 4 days from his father's description. And then what happens on July 7th? Lieutenant General Nathan Twining arrived at Alamogordo Army Airfield for a secret meeting with Army Airfield Chief of Staff Spots and to view recovered remains of the craft from Landing Zone 2. This is from the what would be White Sands at the Trinity site. On 8 July, Twining visited Kirtland Army Airfield to inspect parts recovered from the power plant. And on July 9th, Twining and his staff flew to White Sands Proving Ground to inspect pieces of craft being stored there. And on July 10th, made inspection of R&D facilities at Alamogordo and then returned to Wright Field, Ohio. So, George, here is a perfect description of details, of names and events that would explain who the big shots were to Patrick Murphy's father, Captain Murphy, and why did they need 2 or 3 days of these big cargo planes going between Roswell and Wright Field. It's because they were transporting material from at least three crash sites, not just one.
Linda, what's up next half hour?
Another echo of everything that has happened in Roswell, a haunting place in which it appears to be cycles that persist of UFO phenomena in this place, in southern New Mexico, in the Roswell region, that on the one hand is desert, and yet the reports that continue to come over the years of huge and strange craft is in this next report. It is truly haunting.
All right, stay with us. Linda's website, of course, earthfiles.com, and you can email her at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. We'll come back with her final story in the next hour. It'll be Conversations with Linda right here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, next hour we'll take your questions and phone calls with Linda. That's how we get our great information. And when we come back, there's more of her stories on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with reporter and investigator Linda Moulton Howe. Linda, by the way, you and I will be at Conscious Life in February.
That's right. I'm looking forward to it. I'll see you there,
conference.
I hope.
Oh, absolutely. I will be. I'm heading up a panel there. So
good.
Let's spend some time together.
Yeah.
Okay. What's our next one? Go ahead.
Well, we were in 47, and now we're going to jump to October 1, 2006 in Roswell, but in an eerie way, it's all part of the same decades-long story. There's a man named Patrick Colligan. He was born 53 years ago in Buffalo, New York. He graduated from Orchard Park High School in January of 1976 and then enlisted in the U.S. Air Force. Eventually, in 1977, Patrick Colligan graduated from the Nuclear Weapons Special School at Lowry Air Force Base in Denver, Colorado. He had assignments from July 1977 to July 1980 at RAF Bentwaters Woodbridge in England, and then back to the United States at the SAC base stationed in Rome, New York, at Griffiths Air Force Base until January of 1981. And finally, after honorable discharge from the U.S. Air Force, he earned a degree in 1985 in exotic animal training and management. And Pat Colligan first worked as a professional wild animal trainer for movies and television in Los Angeles, and then he moved on to the San Diego Wild Animal Park until 1998. And then he and his wife decided that they wanted to move to less population. And on March 4th, 2002, this man with military background and working with wild animals clearly has a lot of courage. He got hired as a corrections officer for the Roswell Correctional Center. It's a New Mexico state prison. It's also known here as RCC. And it's about 20 to 25 miles south of downtown Roswell. And there's a very interesting point here. When you do history about Walker Field and the World War II environment in Roswell, you learn that they made half a dozen or so what they called auxiliary airfields. Mm-hmm. And they did them in various places away from downtown Roswell. And these were, the one I'm going to be talking about had paved runways, and there are underground tunnels under to this day under where they made these auxiliary airfields. And the one about 20 to 25 miles south of downtown Roswell is what was converted into the Roswell Correction Center. And so this prison is on the same ground, in the same place, that all these underground tunnels and all these auxiliary airports were made during World War II as backups and protections and probably hiding highly classified materials. And on October 1st, 2006, only 5 years ago, Pat Colligan was on the night shift. Around 11 p.m., a car arrived at the front gate with some Spanish parents and a son who was driving at the time. The family had come to pick up another son who was being paroled at midnight. Pat met them at the gate and asked them to park across the cattle guard outside the prison's front gate. They followed Pat's instructions, and he drove to a spot behind the prison, directly behind the prison chapel, so that he could watch the perimeter fence and the family's car at the same time. He told me, quote, "I usually like to do that and keep a car under surveillance for the first few minutes after it is parked, just to see if anything irregular occurs," close quote. And the place where Pat Colligan parked is very remote. He rolled his truck window down for some fresh air, and then he was stunned by what he saw out the window. Here now is Correctional Officer Pat Colligan.
All of a sudden, to my left out the window, something very, very, very strange appeared. There was a popping sound, like pop, 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 and kind of an electrical crackling. And these lights appeared. There was a whole row of lights, one after another.
Color?
They were white, and they were square, one in a row right after another. And they were moving from my right to my left. After the initial popping and crackling, when the appearance occurred, then everything went silent after that. And then they went into a circular pattern. where they still followed one after another, but now they were traveling in a circle coming towards me, pivoting right around in a circle. And I'm just trying to wrap my mind around what I'm looking at. And then they begin traveling back. This time, it's from the left to the right, coming back toward my right, directly in front of me across my field of vision. This is maybe a few hundred yards off, the length of two or three football fields in front of me. As it passes back again, the second time in front of me from left to right, moving at a very slow, steady pace, the entire craft comes into view, and it's a giant flying saucer. It's a dull gray in color. I'm seeing the entire structure of the craft and everything. It's a solid craft, a dull gray. The lights that I saw initially are the windows. Well, this thing was a cup on top of a cup, but in the middle section, there was a big area in the middle. And in that area is where there were windows running the length of the craft. And there was actually structure between the windows. And I would guesstimate each of the windows to be about maybe the size of a trailer home. I was looking at it from the side. I counted 8 windows that were in my field of vision before it went around the curve of the ship.
How wide would each of these windows be?
Between 50 and 80 feet. It had the saucer part, you know, the dome on top, dome on the bottom. Okay, it was all dull gray. And the middle section is where the windows were. And they seemed to go right around the thing with ship structure between them.
Meaning silver metal that you could see reflecting from the light coming out of those windows?
Oh, yeah. There was craft separating each window. I'm pretty sure they went all the way around because when I saw the thing go into a rotation, it was lights all the way as it was rotating.
If there were 8 windows, each approximately 80 feet long, then you're describing something that is at least 650 feet wide.
It was big. It was so close, I was scared. I mean, I reached down. I had the shotgun sitting right next to me. I reached down for the shotgun, and I thought, no. I said, this is going to be of no use to me. I wanted to make myself as inconspicuous as I could be. I checked my headlights, and thank God my lights are out. It was so close, I was frightened for my own safety. Hmm. I felt very, very small. And the impression that entered my mind at that point was aircraft carrier. I don't know why, but I just got that impression. And it was a very large craft, and it was on a glide path. In silence, smooth. This thing, it was so smooth and so quiet.
You had the impression of a naval aircraft carrier. Why do you think you had that impression?
I don't know. That thought just entered my mind. Aircraft carrier. Maybe it was the size. I don't know, but I just got that mental impression. Two mental impressions I got. One was I reached for the shotgun beside me, and I put my hand on the shotgun, and it was like, no. This is going to be of no use to me. And then I got the impression, an aircraft carrier.
Is it possible that your sudden impression of an aircraft carrier related to the function of this gigantic craft, not from Earth?
It's possible. And, of course, I have no way of knowing.
An aircraft carrier in something from outer space would mean what to you?
Oh, I would think it would be a craft that other smaller vessels would come and go from. I mean, that's what I would think of, a space aircraft carrier, sure. Just the way we launch planes from our aircraft carriers. And just after it passes by me, I can only describe it as it cloaks. It does this phase shifting or something, and it does this sort of, and it just becomes invisible. It's still moving at the same pace and the same path.
If you hear this noise, that seems to sync up with it becoming invisible. How do you know, sitting in your truck in the dark, that it's still there?
Because the lights on the inside, see, there were lights, white light emanating from the inside of the craft through the windows. The lights were still on. So when it started doing this, the last thing I could still see were the lights. And then the lights went out, not in one motion, but two. It was like bink, bink. The interior lights went out. And at that point, it was completely invisible. And it did all this while it was on this little like glide slowly past me. And it was heading in the direction of, I was positioned as the crow flies. I was about 20 to 25 miles south of the town of Roswell. And it was on a glide path toward the town of Roswell, and both the town and base. You can see them both on the horizon. I sat there for another 2 minutes watching just to see if anything else happened. I didn't want to miss it. And nothing else occurred. So I kept my headlights out, and I drove from that position over to the side of our master control center, and I parked in a lit area there and just sort of gathered myself together, you know, about what I'd just seen.
Did you call anybody?
No. Well, right then I grabbed a blank log sheet and I wrote down what I could. Well, it's right fresh. I wrote down on a page. I kept that. And what I did next was I drove over to where I had had those people park. As I came up to their car, the man rolled down the window, who was behind the wheel, and his father was sitting next to him in the passenger seat. And I said, "Sir, did you notice anything unusual?" And the man had, his eyes were big like saucers, and he was staring straight at me, almost like hypnotic. And his mouth was moving, but no words were coming out. And the woman in the back seat, who was this man's wife, she leaned over the back seat, and then she said, "Oh, yes, I saw the giant saucer. It flew right through there." And she pointed to the prison chapel, and she said, "Then it crashed right into that building."
What?
And she said, "We couldn't figure out, why was there no explosion? Why was there no fire? It ran right into that building." What I realized later was that they saw the craft at least from the point when it was doing the pivoting rotation and traveling back in my direction, because that was going toward the prison chapel. Now, at the point where the craft passed behind the prison chapel is the place at which the cloaking occurred. So they saw it fly in, from their perspective, fly into the chapel. It was actually flying behind the chapel, never came out the other side. And they just could not wrap their minds around what they saw. Why was there no explosion? Why was there no fire? I knew that they had seen it too. And the sighting occurred at 11:15 p.m. on October the 1st, 2006.
Did you ever call any airport authority, police, fire, or anyone?
No.
Because?
Oh, God. I mean, I didn't want attention, especially negative attention from this thing.
That is eerie, isn't it, George?
It sure is, Linda.
And especially when you raise this question, why is Roswell, New Mexico, the focus of what appears to be other intelligences from someplace else? Why do they focus on Roswell? We know that we did test the first atomic bomb at the Trinity site at White Sands Proving Ground in July of 1945. And that was a month or so, I guess, before we dropped two over Japan in August of 1945. And one military source back in 1990 told me that the UFO phenomena involves tears or holes in the electromagnetic fields of Earth, and that they can be provoked from the outside by intelligences, or there can be natural collapses in the Earth's magnetic field. And what I've often wondered, and that man and I talked about this, could the atomic test at White Sands in July of 1945 have torn open something in the electromagnetic field of Earth that we didn't understand then, might still not fully understand now, and that this either sent out a signal or allowed the opening for, let's say, monitors, probes to come and find out what was happening on this planet that could tear open electromagnetic fields, perhaps not just in this, we'll call this three-dimensional matter world, but maybe into other dimensions, as people in the human abduction syndrome have said over and over for years, that we do not understand that atomic bombs tear open some kind of fabric in other dimensions. Well, it was, to me, one of the more fascinating parts of discussion with Army Lieutenant Colonel Philip Porso before he died. Back in 1998, he had released the book the day after Roswell in July of 1997 on the 50th anniversary of the crashes. And he sat and talked to me for some time about his knowledge that our government had studied nine geographic areas around this planet where the magnetic fields were thought to naturally collapse periodically on some kind of natural, either a cycle or conditions would build up and the magnetic fields would collapse for a period, and that it would, that might make it possible for other life forms to enter here, meaning that in the period of the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, that our government was clearly focused on trying to understand how the propulsion systems worked, how these in life forms seemed to move point to point, how they used magnetic fields and the collapse of magnetic fields, and that today, in 2011, we have just heard a correctional officer down in Roswell who had an experience in 2006 that is eerie in its cloakingness, as if something is coming back on a constant monitoring path, a monitoring cycle, and cloaks itself as it moves off toward Roswell to do what? Question mark. And Pat Colligan said, this is not the first sighting that he has had. He knows of other people, as if there is some kind of persistent phenomena. And since this is Christmas time and we're moving into the new year that has that number 2012 on it, I thought that I would close out this whole section on a question: if we're dealing with other intelligences, what is their nature? And is there something about the nature of this non-human intelligence that persists in very regular cycles, in monitoring, interaction, intrusions, returning, and bases on this planet? And I'm now going to The Mayan Factor by Jose Arguelles that came out in 1987, a powerful book. And in it, he said, like the Buddhist and Hindu cosmologies, the Mayan describe a universe of infinite cycles of time and being. If anything, the Mayan is even more precise in its computation of these cycles. And this
Well, something's going on, Linda. No doubt about that. We'll be right back.